water bath. He had a piece of waveguide which looked like a downspout tubing from a house, aluminum downspout tubing. He put it at a grazing angle into a trough of water so that if you looked at the water inside, it was a wedge of water. And that became almost a perfect absorber, a perfect dummy load. So at 2 meters and 450, water in a cable can easily become very lossy so that the cable acts like an attenuator, a slightly mismatched attenuator. And so the RF energy is hitting the watery section, being turned into heat, very little that's left over to get to the antenna. So you are making all of your instrumentation measurements at the input end of the cable only. If you take that bad piece of cable, which probably was soldered at the mag mount or at the NMO, and put a connector on that end, and now measure the cable's insertion loss, transmitting a known amount of power into the input end, and find out how much comes out of the output end, I think you're going to see it. You're going to see a healthy amount of decibels of loss because of the water. The water is a distributed attenuator, which may not show up as vizwar at the input end, but it does show up as a hell of a lot of loss as to what gets to the far end. I'm going to guess the piece of RG58 was something like 5 or 8 feet long. Is that about true, Joe? The B2RYY, wait for the beep, K2RIW.
Approximately 15, maybe 16 foot of cable from end to end. But it still just got me curious at why you couldn't see that reflected energy coming back. If the water is absorbing the RF energy going through, why is it not reflecting, or giving you a very high reflected factor coming back towards the transmitter end of the cable?
Okay, I'm going to change the experiment. You've got a black box with that bad piece of cable, and you measure the input and the output, and you see a great big loss, and you measure the input reflection, you don't see very much loss. If in the second black box, I've got a pair of cables, RG58, quality cables, but in between the two cables, I put a 20 decibel attenuator, and the 20 decibel attenuator is a little bit sloppy in its construction. Instead of it being 50 ohms in and out, it's 35 ohms in and out. I've now got 20 decibels of attenuation, input to output, by way of the attenuator I put in the middle of the cable, and the reflected energy I see is just a little bit of reflected energy because of the mismatch, because I made it a 35 ohm attenuator instead of a 50 ohm attenuator. The water can do all of that, Joe. It gives you a slight impedance mismatch, but it's a distributed attenuator, distributed power absorber. And once you absorb the power, there's nothing left to reflect back to you, if you know what I mean. And there's not very much left over to get through the cable to get to the antenna. Water can do all of that at VHF frequencies. A couple of drops of water in the middle of a type N connector at the top of your tower on 432 can be a 10 decibel attenuator, and it'll give you about a 1.5 standing wave ratio. W2RYY, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, so if you had a condition like this, the only way to be able to test your antenna transmission circuit completely, if you didn't have immediate access to the top of the tower, if you measured it a continuity check and you saw a continuity across the cable, you could assume that the water is, you know, giving you some resistance across the cable, maybe in meg ohms or high K ohms or something like that. And that would be difficult if the other end of the circuit had a type of antenna that had a DC short on the antenna cable.
Absolutely right. Been there, done that. I used to insist that all my 432 antennas had a folded dipole floating driven element assembly fed by way of a coax balun. Therefore, if the antenna system and the 16 connectors on the 16 Yagis were all doing their job, in the shack, I'd measure with an ohmmeter from the center conductor to shield, and I'd measure 10 megohms on a good day. As water started getting into any one of those 16 connectors, and DC-wise, they're all in parallel, even though there's a power divider in between them, coax-type power divider, I would start seeing numbers like 100K, 50K, as it started coming down because water was getting into the connectors. My signal in 432 got weak real fast, and I could find out real fast by way of the ohmmeter test. Unfortunately, I got fooled because I was using FM8 cable, which in its day was considered real good stuff made by ITT. It was foam-filled cable. Water was slowly walking through the outer jacket into the braid, into the foam, and it eventually became a distributed attenuator. When I finally took that antenna down, I found out that each one of my coax cables of the phasing harness had something like 3 or 4 dB of loss, even though they were only a couple of feet long, because of the water that had slowly been absorbed into the foam, and it became lossy. It didn't show up as significant viswap. It didn't show up as significant ohms between center conductor and ground, but boy, was it one hell of an attenuator. Water makes an extremely good dummy load at VHF frequencies, and even at UHF frequencies. Your microwave oven at 2450 megacycles cooks your food, and you don't know it, but 95% of all of the heating of your food is heating the water that's in your food. You put a glass of water and an extremely dry old piece of bread side by side in the microwave oven, run the microwave oven for a minute, the water will get hot, the bread will stay cold. It's the water that does the heating. The water does the heating by way of the fact that the water molecule is a dipole molecule. On each half cycle of the RF energy, that molecule is flipping back and forth following the E field, and it does it with a certain insertion loss, and that's the loss mechanism. Water makes a very good dummy load at microwave frequencies. Over to you, Joe. K2RIW. Clearly?
Okay. Last part of the question is, now that you know all this and said all this, is there any other way that you know of without being able to take the cable part end-to-end and do a continuity check? Of course, say you don't have easy access to the far end of the transmission circuit and you're using an antenna system that happens to have something like a DC short. For example, a base station antenna that has a DC short like a station master. So as far as continuity would be concerned, you go across the cable and it shows close to zero ohm. So you certainly can't see your 500K worth of resistance that the water would give you across the transmission line. Of the circuit. Stop stepping on me.
The answer to your question is no. You want to be able to make the measurement in the shack, so to speak, and to confirm the integrity of the whole transmission line plus antenna system. The answer is no. Because of the insidiousness of water, because water is such a nasty, distributed, attenuating material, and because if it's a foam-filled cable, it might not show up as ohm. It won't show up as ohm, even if the antenna is an open circuit. And the antenna won't, even if the antenna is an open circuit, the ohm meter test is a necessary but not sufficient. The only way you can truly confirm is to measure how much power goes into the cable and how much comes out of the other end. If you're not willing to climb the tower and confirm the cable that way, the only thing you've got left to do is to measure field strength coming out of the antenna, which is exactly what you did. There is no other confirmation, because there's a zillion ways that that cable can become lossy, and half of those ways the cable becomes lossy, you cannot detect that in the shack. Ain't that terrible? That's what you got to learn to live with. That's why you made that measurement of minus 70 versus minus 50, Joe. You did the right thing. You had no choice. For B2RYY for a final, K2RYW in the tech net.
TDR measurement.
TDR will not show it. TDR is measuring whether or not there is a fixed point of perturbation. Water distributed throughout the foam of a cable is a distributed insertion loss material. It's like having 15 1-ohm attenuators all stacked in series with each other. A TDR will not show that. Good common sense, it won't work. Over to you, Joe, for a final.
Question on the subject.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, the antenna that he's using, it's a DC short. Is that also shorted to its bracket, which is mounted to the tower?
What tower is a mobile installation? The only reason I brought up the thing about the DC short, in case you had the same type of thing happen on a base station installation with a grounded type of antenna.
Yeah, Joe did mention it was an NMO connector, which is that Motorola-like connector that you drill a hole in the sheet metal of the car and you mount the damn thing, and it becomes the whip mount for the antenna. So even if the bracket of the antenna is grounded or not grounded to the tower, even if you have the ability to measure the short circuit, making it an open circuit, no.
It does make a difference, Dick.
When you get distributed loss, distributed throughout the cable, there is no ohmmeter test that will positively show that to you. There is no TDR test that will show that to you. There is no VISWR test that will show that to you.
Disagree.
I think if you've got distributed loss, say for instance I've got water distributed throughout 10 foot of a 50 foot cable, and throughout that 10 foot, it's now giving me a 10 dB insertion loss, but it doesn't show up as an ohmmeter, it doesn't show up as reflected power, it only shows up as decreased power getting to the far end of the cable. Tell me how you would confirm that one without measuring the power at the far end of the cable, John. KC2WGB, K2RW, the TechNet.
I'd apply a HiPod machine on it. I'd HiPod the cable. If even on a tower, if the antenna is not bracketed and grounded to the tower, you could do it on a tower too. Put it in the car, could have HiPodded that wire, would have shown it right away.
So you're telling me the HiPod will show something that the ohmmeter will not show? Maybe yes, maybe no. When you've got a whole bunch of foam that is closed cell foam, but the water has migrated through those individual cells, but the cells are individually insulated from each other by that closed cell foam, would the HiPod arc through all of those individual barriers of those individual closed cells so that you can see the presence of the water in them? It's a little bit catchy. It might work, it might not work, John. I think the only real acid test is how much signal is getting to the far end. You either open up the far end and measure the power that's getting there, or you measure the field strength the antenna is radiating. That's the real acid test. My strongest recommendation, because an awful lot of us don't own a HiPod, John, is to really measure how much power is radiated by the antenna, and if you're smart enough, that is a deterministic test. In other words, if you know the antenna has got 10 dB of gain, and you know you're putting 20 watts into it, and you know you're making the measurement from X distance away, you can calculate to the nearest fraction of a dB how much signal you should be receiving on, say, your spectrum analyzer, which is what Joe did. That's the real acid test. Is it radiating the power you're putting into the cable? Because there's a zillion ways the cable can give you a lack of that power being delivered to the antenna, but it might not be showing up in the shack. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, coaxial cable, besides a mess of tests they make on them, they also take the entire reel and they submerge it and they evacuate the chamber, and all you have is your beginning lead and your tail lead coming out. That goes on a HiPod machine. Under evacuation, the water will migrate through any pinholes or anything in there. It will show up immediately on a HiPod tester. So I understand that they don't usually have those things, but that is one way to confirm it. Of course, if it's grounded at the top of the tower, that's not going to prove anything.
Yeah, you do have a possible test for measuring the, hermeticity, weatherproofing, whatever, of the cable by way of vacuuming the cable while it's underwater. That's a pretty severe test. In the case of a polyethylene-like cable, I'd be tempted to go there. In the case of a foam-filled cable, I wouldn't want to do that test. There's a whole lot of things that could... the water could be giving you damage that doesn't show up until some number of months or years downrange. Because water gets through that outer black polyvinyl chloride jacket, it looks to you and me like a perfect weather seal. It isn't. It is a... it's a weather seal. It's not a hermetic seal. Water vapor will slowly migrate through that outer black jacket. I had it happen with all of my 16 jumpers of that ITT FM8 cable. I mean, if one of those 16 jumpers was extra lossy because of water in the foam, I'd say, yeah, I did a lousy job of putting on the connector. All 16 of them measured after 5 years of use the exact same amount of increase in loss, tremendous increase in loss from end to end of each of those jumpers. I can't believe that every one of those carefully installed type N connectors had all become leaky by the exact same amount. That water had migrated through the cable. The bottom line is, if you really want foam-filled cable to have longevity in your indication, in your installation, it cannot have a braid as the outer conductor. It's got to be hardline. That's the only thing that really is a hermetic seal. Any foam-filled, flexible a braided outer cable will slowly absorb water, even though it's just the jumper that's a couple of feet going around your rotator, and it's going to give you increased loss at VHF frequencies downrange. That's the reason why my jumper, even though it's got extra loss, is always a solid piece of polyethylene RG9 cable. Over to you, John. It's time for your mailbag. KC2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
Did you be? Am I making it over that thing?
Yes, you are, and interrupt periodically. We might have to go to one of the other inputs, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Very good. You're right. The cable itself, besides capillary action, when it's warmed in the sunshine, it breathes, and it will cause water to migrate into that cable. And if it's the cellular foam, it can give you a problem. And we detected quite a few errors by the IPOP method. Of course, that is not considered non-destructive. Of course, the cable's almost useless after it. So I don't know what the advantage was, but that's what we had to do. Okay, if you're ready, I'll go to the first question.
Fire when ready.
Okay, we have a young ham who visited the amateur radio, Dot Tango Victor, and listened to all of the comments on decibels, so we can help drive a stake through the heart of this vampire for this gentleman, because he didn't understand fully. There's too many designations, which you have gone through many times, dBm, dBv, dBi, and quick description of the differences, but what he would like is he's given two examples of a 1,000 microvolt signal being decreased by 20 dB. He'd like to know the math on that. Same issue at 17 dB. How would that be calculated? Then he wants to know at 1,000 milliwatts, the same numbers, 20 dB and 17 dB, so that he can get a way of figuring the calculations and why it's different between power and voltage. I know you've covered this many times, but evidently it wasn't clear enough on the site. So maybe you could go through that. KC2WT, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you'd be amazed how many engineers with 4 years of higher education on this subject have trouble with this one. And lots of hams have trouble with it. Decibels are always a ratio. When I measure volts, if someone tells me this particular battery is giving me 1.5 volts, that is an absolute reading. If somebody told me this particular battery is 1.5 decibels above that battery, because decibels are always a ratio, it's got to be compared to something. So in the case of dBm, dB, the M stands for milliwatt, so with ratio to 1 milliwatt, 10 dB, for instance, is 10 times more power. 20 dB is 100 times more power. 30 dB is 1,000 times more power. So the 10, the 20, the 30, the first digit, 1, 2, or 3, is telling you the number of zeros that you put after the 1 to give you the power ratio. And that works very nice when you've got increments of 10 decibels of power. So if I had a 1,000 milliwatt signal, that's a fancy way of saying 1,000 times stronger than 1 milliwatt, that would be a 30 dBm signal. So 1,000 milliwatts is a 30 dBm power level, because you're comparing it to a milliwatt, 1 milliwatt, and the 1,000-1 ratio is 30 dB. 20 decibels weaker than a plus 30 dBm signal would be a plus 10 dBm signal. You're allowed to subtract and add decibels directly when somebody says make it 20 dB weaker or make it 10 dB weaker. You're allowed to directly subtract those decibels. So if I had a plus 30 dBm signal and I make...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And I make it 20 dB weaker, I end up with plus 10 dBm. 10 dB with reference to a milliwatt, since 10 dB is a 10 to 1 power ratio, and the comparison is 1 milliwatt, the reference, that is a 10 milliwatt signal. That's one of the places where 10 dBm, in dBm and in milliwatts, the numbers come out the same, plus 10. What would a minus 10 dBm signal be? 10 decibels can be negative And if I'm minus 10 dBm, that means I am 10 decibels weaker than 1 milliwatt, and 10 decibels is always a 10 to 1 ratio. 10 times weaker than 1 milliwatt is 1/10 of a milliwatt. Now, decibels with reference to power and making them increase and decrease, relatively easy to handle. Mathematically, what you do is you take the number of decibels, divide it by 10, raise, now you do an anti-logging operation. You raise 10 to the power of that new number if you did the division. Let's give you an example of that. Let's assume now that someone tells me I've got a plus 30 dBm signal. And I happen not to remember all of those tricks of the ratios. Let me drop. And somebody asks me, what is the real power of a plus 30 dBm signal? I would take the 30, divide by 10, I end up with 3. I raise 10 to the power of 3, 10 to the third power, happens to be 1,000. Therefore, I know a plus 30 dBm signal is 1,000 milliwatts. So with reference to power, things are pretty simple. With reference to current or voltage, it starts getting a little bit more complicated. You got to be careful. Decibels with reference to voltage, and now we're talking about dBmV, in other words, or dBmu, they call it. In other words, the cable television companies, they have a standard unit of 1 microvolt. So they talk about dB with reference to 1 microvolt. A plus 40 dB stronger than 1 microvolt happens to be a pretty strong signal for a cable TV system. And now your question is, how do you convert dB microvolts back into real volts? And because whenever you're not dealing with power, when you're dealing with either voltage or current, the formula for converting your ratio is voltage 1 divided by voltage 2. You do that division, you take log to the base 10, and you multiply by 20 to convert it to decibels. So there's a 20 dB ratio number with reference to volts and current. There's only a 10 dB ratio number when it comes to power. I know that's kind of crazy. So if I had a signal of plus 20 dB with reference to a microvolt, to convert it into volts, I take the 20 dB microvolt, divide it by 20, I end up with 1, I raise 10 to the power of 1, I end up with 10, so that I know that...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Millivolts, the cable TV.
I think it's microvolts, but I'm not positive on that one. But if it could be dB with millivolts or dB with microvolts. Anyhow, in my example of, if someone told me it's a plus 20 dB microvolt with reference to a microvolt signal, and I want to convert it into volts, I first take the plus 20 microvolt, divide it by 20, end up with 1, take 10, raise to the power of 10, I end up with 10. Therefore, a plus 20 dB microvolt signal is 10 times above 1 microvolt. It is 10 microvolts. So the mathematics of logging and anti-logging, you have to first either multiply or divide by 10 if you're dealing with power. You have to multiply by 20 if you're dealing with voltage or current. And you got to be careful when you're dealing with voltage or current. It only makes sense if the impedances are the same. If I have 1 volt coming from a signal generator at 50 ohms, and after a great big long chunk of cable, I'm putting some number of volts into a load, which is 10 ohms instead of 50 ohms, and I measure some volts on the far end, and I now take the output volts versus the input volts, and I use the 20 dB log formula, I'll come up with a number. It doesn't have anywhere near the meaning you think it has. So when you're dealing with dB volts or dB current, it only has meaning in the direct sense if the impedances are matched. So I'm reasonably sure that a cable TV system measures decibels with reference to a microvolt. I don't think it's with reference to a millivolt. I wonder if anyone on frequency can confirm that one. K2IYW listening.
WB2IKT. It's a millivolt. 0 dBmV is a millivolt.
and it's the reference level chosen because that's the weakest signal that produces a still-free television picture.
All righty, dB with reference. So, 0 dBmV, millivolt, I think you're saying, is a good strong signal. Would minus 10 dBmV still be usable? IKT, go ahead.
In the old NTSC system, a minus 10 dBmV signal would be so weak, but you could still look at it. Nobody would consider it a good signal. 0 dBmV is about where you're just, for the average viewer, it's essentially considered snow-free with an average television set from the day, you know, from the mid-60s or so when they adopted the standard.
Now, when it comes to decibels, you have to first remember that decibels are always a ratio. And the various decibel units, boy, there's a zillion of them. The radar people use DBZ. That really means volumetric attenuation because there's some precipitation, because there's some kind of rain or snow in that volume of air that your radar signal is going through. There's also dB with reference to a square meter, DBSM, I guess it's called. In other words, a particular radar target, which is the reference, is a 1 square meter reference radar reflection target. And if my target happens to be 10 decibels louder than that, I would call it a 10 dB with reference to a square meter radar target. I remember once measuring a target that was 47 dB stronger than a square meter, which is approximately equal to what an aircraft carrier will give you as an echo broadside. Really big echoes. So decibels are not simple. It takes a while to work with them. And you'd be amazed how many people will see the number 0 decibels written on a page. And they assume if it's dBm, 0 dBm, that it's zero signal. Uh-huh. 0 decibel, 0 dBm happens to be 0 dB ratio with reference to 1 milliwatt, and it happens to be 1 milliwatt. If I take 10 and raise it to the zero power, the answer is unity, 1. So a 0 dBm signal is 1 milliwatt. It's considerably stronger than a minus 10 dBm signal. It's considerably weaker than a plus 10 dBm signal. So in the decibel scale, 0 decibels is a very valid number. Many signal generators don't go very far above 0 dBm of power output on their dial. That's one of the many areas that people have trouble with.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
This is far from the whole story, John, but I think it'll help a little bit. KC2 WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Well, I think that gives them a little more of a foundation. First of all, you have to remember it's always a ratio. Numbers really meaningless without that ratio. And he'll be working with it, I'm sure. But gives him a little better idea, maybe a little clearer than what we had before. If you got time, I got one more. Not so much a ham question, but a little science question.
Go for it, Jack.
Okay. He's got a good one here. If we could construct a wire that was one atom in diameter, and now we have a line of atoms, and we impress a DC voltage on there, we would be able to watch the atoms travel down, or the electrons travel down the wire. Now, if we put an AC signal and keep raising the frequency until the frequency causes the oscillating electrons to only move 50% of their width, they're only oscillating between 200% of their diameter. So, how are they moving down the line?
That is a good question, and I've been there. The amount of charge that's in a piece of copper wire of any reasonable diameter, very few of us are ever going to have a copper wire that's only one atom in diameter. And we could talk about that as a thought experiment. Could you really do it? Probably not. But any reasonable piece of wire, the total number of molecules that are there, the total number of free electrons, if it's copper, there's only one extra free electron free to float around per copper module, copper molecule, so there's a huge number of them. That cable that goes between the battery and the starter motor of your car has a number of free electrons in it, that if Mother Nature would allow you to create the imbalance, if she would allow you to drain those free electrons in that piece of copper cable, you could draw 200 amperes out of that cable for 4 solid hours. That's how much charge there is in that cable because of one single electron free to move out of each individual copper molecule that's in that cable. Now you relate it to the real 80-meter dipole you've got in your backyard, made out of 14-gauge household wire. And that 14-gauge household wire, I'm going to make a guess, it's in the vicinity of an eighth inch in diameter. Let me drop. And I'm putting 70 watts of RF energy into that antenna. Assume the antenna has got a 70 ohm impedance. Therefore, I'm putting 1 ampere of RF current into that antenna. 1 ampere of RF current at 70 volts. I'm putting a 70-watt signal into that 80-meter dipole in my backyard. So for half of the cycle of the 3.5 megacycle signal, current is flowing to the right. In other words, some electrons are coming out of the left-hand side of the dipole and being pumped into the right-hand side of the dipole. On the second half, they're moving the other direction. You do a simple calculation because you know the frequency is 3.5 megacycles. That's, let me think now. If it was 1 megacycle, it would be 1 microsecond. It's a third of a microsecond, roughly 300 nanoseconds. So for 300 nanoseconds is a full cycle. For 150 nanoseconds, that's a half cycle. For 150 nanoseconds, I'm pumping current to the right. And the next half cycle, for 150 nanoseconds, I'm pumping signal to the left. And I'm pumping 1 ampere. And we know, we can define what 1 ampere is. We know how many electrons have to move. We know the diameter of the wire. And you calculate what's going on in that wire. And you'll easily come to the conclusion that each of those electrons in that wire, on average, are moving a small fraction of the diameter of one particular copper molecule. That's what's happening at 80 meters. What's happening if I'm running a minus 10 dBm signal at 10 gigahertz into a very small dipole that's a half inch long at 10 gigahertz? Now the frequency is so much higher, the amount of time that I'm spending sending the current to the right and the amount of time on the second half cycle I spend going to the left, we're now talking about a tenth of a nanosecond. And because the signal is so weak, I'm only pumping amount of current of a very small fraction of a milliampere or a microampere, maybe a nanoampere.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
How far do the molecules move? And we're now talking about, you know, 1/1,000,000th of the diameter of a molecule. And at first you would say, hey, no real motion is taking place. Well, you're assuming in your simplistic diagram that if you sat there with your super microscope, if you had one, that you could see those electrons flying by. That's not the way it works. There's this random cloud of electrons in a very complicated random motion, so to speak. And the best way I can put this, when you zoom back far enough, you can talk about the average current that's flowing because of what your signal generator is doing. But at the molecular level, the random motion is dominating. In other words, you wouldn't be able to tell the random motion versus the organized motion you're creating by way of your signal generator. A better way of looking at it is that the current that you and I put into a wire, the current that I'm putting into a wire is very close to, the best way you can consider it is marbles in a pipe, and the marbles are packed real tight. I know that when I put a load at the far end of the wire, and some current flows out of the far end, it's the equivalent of a marble popping out of the far end, my battery puts another marble into the near end. So what's happening at the end versus the beginning is like marbles in a pipe. If the particular red electron coming out of my car battery right now, I painted one of those electrons red in my example, and my starter motor is locked rotor drawing 200 amperes. My starter motor is drawing 200 amperes on this cold morning, locked rotor.
so why don't we just go shopping? I'm dragging, I'm flagging, I'm flying, maybe it's just that hit.
And I'm watching that red electron proceed down that cable. It would take roughly 4 hours on average for that red electron to get from the battery through that copper cable, 3 feet apart, 3 foot downrange, and get into my starter motor. There's that much charge in between. So because the charge is so huge, the number of electrons is so huge, compared to the tiny amount of current by comparison that I'm creating, that in almost all situations where you're putting AC signal, the 60 cycle current flowing into that wall socket of yours, how far are those electrons moving? You'd be amazed how many people think that an electron is coming out of the power company, going all the way through that wire, down to my light bulb, and then going back again. At the 60 cycle rate, you calculate how far those electrons move, and I don't think they're moving a nanometer, if you know what I mean, on each half of the 60 cycles. So on every one of the situations you and I can envision, with rare exception, the electrons are moving a very small fraction of the diameter of the copper molecule.
Should we be talking about density of the current?
Doesn't matter. Density, current, no matter how you look at it, in most of the situations, the total amount of motion, on average, is very, very small. I know that's a hard concept to accept. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
VY1PVH.
KC2WGB. Well, Dick, his claim is, if we use the marbles in the pipe, if we have an AC signal and we are at a high frequency, that red marble that comes out of the supply into the line, one comes out. If we had a regular, say, a light bulb operating this frequency, that same red marble will return back to the generator. So it's really gone nowhere.
Also, jiggling of the electrons left and right because of the sine wave.
Yeah, on each half of the sine wave, they move very, very small amount. I heard something that sounded like close to WA1VDH. Give me your full call letters and name, sir. K2RIW.
WA1VVH.
Okay, that's Harold, WA1VVH. Go ahead, Harold.
Just checking in, letting you know the band conditions are up a little bit, so I've been listening here for a while. WA1VVH.
And he's way up there in the New Hampshire area. Is it New Hampshire or Massachusetts? Which is it, Harold? I keep forgetting.
You know, I'm in Massachusetts, but I could walk to New Hampshire from where I am here. I'm that close.
Yeah, that's what I remember. He's in northern Massachusetts, right on the New Hampshire border, and he's listening to us on 2 meters. Just happens to be using a Rhone 55 tower, something like 150 foot tall, with some very nice antennas on the top of it. Okay, back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
As I was referring to his comment, the red marble comes out at the AC frequency, but then goes back into the supply generator. So that marble really just goes in and out of that pipe. It's not going anywhere, is what he's claiming.
Also, I have a question about jiggling. The positive cycle, the negative cycle, is simply left and right.
He's absolutely right. That marble is coming out of the signal generator, going into the pipe on the first half cycle, coming out of the pipe, going back to the signal generator on the second half cycle. In general, most of the circuits that you and I work with, John, and with, the total amount of average motion of the electrons created by the current that our circuit has created is an extreme. It's an extremely small amount of motion. Opposite of common sense. We envision it to be like water flowing down a stream, if you know what I mean. The charge is so great compared to the amount of current we're drawing, in other words, there's so darn many electrons involved, that their average motion that you and I could measure is extremely small. Most of the time, we're only on an AC circuit, we're moving them nanometers, which is and even much smaller than that. In many cases, we're moving them a small fraction of the diameter of a copper molecule. And at first you would say, gee, that means that nothing is happening. Uh-oh, something is really happening. You got to look at the whole big picture. In that particular case, you look at one single molecule, you'll think nothing is happening, and that's not the right way to look at it. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, I'm sure he has to understand that the energy that is dissipating, it's not the actual electron itself that's going like water through the pipe, it's that energy pulse that's going down that wire. That's how I look at it. But, okay, I'm sure he can work with that, and that's about it from Null's Corner for tonight. Back to you, Dick, and you can pick it up. KC2WGB.
Dick, just a quick question about that what you were just talking about. If you just imagine the mechanical motion with the marble, when each child tried to jiggle the marbles left and right and increase the frequency, there would be one point in which the marble will stay still. Would that happen to electrons when we increase the frequency to infinity?
As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the total amount of time you're spending on the first half cycle and the second half cycle is getting smaller and smaller. Therefore, the total amount of what you think would be motion, how far does it travel before it reverses and goes back, does get smaller and smaller. Wave action, longitudinal wave action, is what we're talking about here. If I added some red dye to a number of water molecules in the ocean, and a wave came by, I'm talking about not a white tap type wave, I'm just talking about an ordinary wave. Somebody dropped a bowling ball into the ocean a quarter of a mile away, and that wave of energy comes by. And now I watch what happens to those water molecules that have the red dye in them. I would see the water molecules move primarily up and down, a little bit of left and right, a little bit of forward and aft. There'd be a slight circular or elliptical motion to them. So the energy of the wave going by moves the individual water molecules, but they do not, on average, get translated. In other words, I now drop 50 bowling balls in a row, and I make 50 individual waves, and I'm still watching this parcel of water that's got the red dye in it, and after wave number one goes by, and after wave number 50 goes by, that parcel of water with the red dye is still in the exact same spot. It didn't propagate. Energy propagated through the water. The water moved in a very characteristic way to convey the energy, but it isn't a total translation of water required to do that. Electrons in the pipe or electrons in a copper wire are somewhat similar to that. So,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
Yeah, that's a great explanation.
Yeah, but Dick, then how would you define the difference between standing wave and wave that we send forward? Is one question. The second question is, what is the magnitude of the vertical movement versus the magnitude of jiggling in horizontal pattern?
This parcel of water that's got the red dye in it, I watch it move primarily up and down, a little bit forward and aft. If I really trace the whole cycle of the wave, it's a slightly elliptical-shaped motion. But it's a cyclic motion. It is not primarily translation. And if now that wave passed my point of observation, hit a concrete wall, and the wave in water reflected back, I've now got standing waves. I've got a wave of motion of the wave going forward. It strikes the concrete wall, and it comes back, and now the wave coming back moves the water in a characteristic way. And now if I'm continuously making these waves in water, continuously crashing against this concrete wall, and continuously coming back, I'll find places in the water where it looks like the wave, the water is simply moving straight up and down, and now the forward and aft motion of the parcel of water with the red dye has almost disappeared. It'll look like I'm only getting up and down motion in some places, and some other places it looks like I'm getting no motion at all, but energy is still being transferred. Standing waves get complicated.
So what about the magnitude of vertical versus horizontal? If horizontal stay is 1 nanometer.
You have to still look at the fact that The forward-going wave is transferring energy forward. The reverse-going wave is traversing energy going aft in the other direction. And the way you get constructive interference in some places and destructive interference in others means, just like the standing wave on the violin string, the standing wave in your coax cable, or the standing wave in the ocean of water, you're going to get a lot of motion of the medium in some places. You're going to get what looks like no motion of the medium in other places. And because you're looking at forward and reverse being mixed together, and you think you see no motion, and you think no energy is taking place, at that point, energy is still taking place.
Thank you. For this time, I'm going to go with the movement of direction, the vertical part, and comparing to the horizontal one, knowing that the horizontal is one nanometer.
In the case of a radio signal going down a coax cable, the forward-going signal has a certain amount of voltage, a certain amount of local current, which flows around the semiconductor of a coax cable in a characteristic way, and the voltage and the current cross multiplication in a vector cross multiplication product gives you something called the pointing vector. Energy is moving down that cable in a particular direction. Water has the equivalent. Waves in the ocean have the equivalent. A signal flowing down a coaxial cable has the equivalent. In any of these cases, when a signal is now reflecting, and the signal reflecting on the violin cable, violin string, has a similar characteristic. When you get energy flowing forward, energy flowing back, you can easily think that no energy is flowing in some particular position, because in that position, you think you're seeing no motion. Or in the case of a coax cable, you think you're seeing no voltage in a particular position, but there's current in that position. There's cyclic voltage in some particular place on the coax cable, a quarter wavelength away with a very high standing wave ratio. You have no voltage cyclically moving, but you've got current cyclically moving. There really is energy going back and forth. I'll admit that in the case of the wave, it's not easy to see the mechanism by which energy is transferred through the areas where you think you see no motion. And the problem is that we naively look... The problem is that when I use a simple voltmeter, I'm not really measuring power. I'm measuring voltage, and if it was a pure 50-ohm system with no standing wave, I assume that there's a 50-ohm load somewhere, and for each 50 volts that flows, 1 ampere of current is being assumed, and therefore I assume that 50 watts is flowing. The problem we make is that we try to make a power measurement by only measuring voltage, or another guy uses a clamp-on ammeter, he tries to make a power measurement by only using amperes. Either one is naive. You got to look at the mixture between the two. We're going to go to Glenn and then over to Paul in that order. Glenn, KC2QIQ. Go ahead with your comment, Glenn. K2LIW.
Exchanging energy between the electrons, but the movement isn't necessarily directly related, you know, to the signal or, you know, the actual motion of the electrons, if that makes any sense. KC2QIQ.
I have a problem with it. If there is no motion, there is no motion.
Yeah, let me ask you this one, Glenn. If I simplify it to be in a simple 1.5-volt flashlight battery, pure DC current, and I've got a, let me pick a number, 1.5-ohm load resistor on this flashlight battery, a size D flashlight battery, 1 ampere of steady current is flowing. I say in that particular case, there is an average transport rate I could talk about those electrons. They are really moving, caused by the, there's a hell of a lot of random motion of those electrons just because they are at roughly 290 degrees Kelvin at my room temperature. Because they're at that elevated temperature, there's a lot of random motion of those free electrons around each one of those copper molecules. But because of what I'm doing with that flashlight battery and the 1.5-ohm load resistor, and I'm creating 1 ampere, I can talk about some average rate of transport of those electrons. And because of what I'm doing, if I could separate that from the normal random motion, if I now calculated the velocity of what I am doing, I think the answer would be some number of nanometers per second of average speed that I'm creating. It would be an amazingly small number because the number of electrons involved is so amazingly large. I wonder if that makes some sense. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I think it does, Dick, except the way that I would describe it more is that amount of Coulomb's energy is the amount of electrons involved, and that when you're looking at the signal of energy, it's the motion of the electron the way that I understand it is basically the transfer of energy from the valence shell. So in other words, there's a polarity involved, which determines the direction, but basically the electrons moving up to the valence shell and then transferring the energy to the valence shell next to it is really the energy transfer, but the electrons themselves are really just still maintained within their own orbits. KC2QIQ.
God, I'm starving. How about the whole buffet?
I've got lost.
Yeah, one definition of an ampere is a coulomb of charge flowing by one point in 1 second. That's 1 ampere, a coulomb of charge. 1.9, 10 to the minus 19 coulombs per single electron. There's roughly 10 to the 20 electrons that have to pass a particular point per second to be 1 ampere.
Or one could look at it as cross-sectional area, and in that cross-sectional area, how many electrons in a copper conductor are involved?
Don't agree. If 1 ampere is flowing through my narrow wire, if 1 ampere is flowing through my big fat wire, in either case, because of what I am doing, 10 to the 20 electrons per second must move to my point of observation. Do you agree or disagree, Glenn?
Disagree. It's a friction, which means that the thin wire is dissipating energy over the friction of the electrons. So you don't have you have the same current only with a fraction of the time as a thick one, and to exchange.
I think I disagree with that. Glenn is going to answer this one. I've got 1 ampere flowing. Assume that 1 ampere is the definition is one coulomb of charge flows through a point of observation in 1 second. One coulomb's worth of electrons is roughly 10 to the 20 power electrons. So an ampere is 10 to the 20 electrons per second moving by a particular point. If I got a skinny wire and an ampere is flowing, and I'm not talking about the power dissipation, I'm just talking about 1 ampere and how many electrons are moving. If 1 ampere is flowing through my skinny wire, and I'm not burning it up, and 1 ampere is flowing through my fat wire, in both cases, roughly 10 to the 20 electrons are moving per second past my point of observation. Do you agree or disagree, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, I disagree, and I'll tell you why I disagree. because what's actually happening is that if you were, your viewpoint is correct, in other words, you're looking at a cross-section, and within that cross-section of a conductor, because the conductor is the copper that has the cross-section with the valence electrons in that area, and the number of coulombs are the amount of available valence electrons at that point that can transfer the energy from one point to another. So if I have the available amount in that area, then the coulomb can flow. So I agree with the term current flow. I agree with the term of the number of electrons involved, but what I don't agree with is that the electron motion is in the direction of the current flow, that the energy is being really what's creating the flow, but the interreaction between the electrons from one valence shell to the valence shell next to it in the direction of the current flow is where the energy is being transferred, but not necessarily the electrons are flowing in directly in the direction of the current flow. KC2QIQ.
We've got to be very careful with the word energy in this case, Glenn. If I've got a fat enough copper wire so that the resistance for the chunk that I'm analyzing is low enough so that when 1 ampere flows through this fat wire, the voltage drops only a nanovolt. The total number of watts being dissipated could be an extremely small number. So energy is not being consumed. Current is all I'm considering. I'm setting up a circuit where externally I'm creating a load. Externally I've got a battery. Because of what I'm doing externally, I'm making an ampere flow. And I'm analyzing the chunk of this wire that has the ampere in it. Because the voltage drop across that wire, if I make it fat enough, is so small, very little energy is being dissipated in that area. All that counts, in my point of view, is that 10 to the 20 electrons are being moved to my point of observation, caused by the fact that I forced 1 ampere to flow. And whether it's a fat wire or a skinny wire, I still got very close to 20 ampere, 10 to the 20 power of electrons flowing from my point of observation. I'll admit you're going to get a different amount of voltage drop and a different amount of wasted energy in the fat wire, the skinny wire versus the fat wire, but that doesn't change the number of electrons. 1 ampere is some number of electrons, 1 coulomb's worth of them, moving by 1 point in 1 second.
Use a superconductor, Dick.
And if it was a superconductor, the current flow, the number of electrons, would be the same. No energy is being wasted at all. And yet I still have an ampere flowing. An ampere is roughly 10 to the 20 electrons per second flowing through the point of observation, and everything else in that simplistic model might not matter. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Here again, I agree with you completely, except the difference where I disagree is when you're saying that they're flowing through. What I'm saying is that when you're looking at a cross-section, regardless of whether it's silver, copper, the density of the copper, when you the current flow and power dissipation, nowhere in when I said current flow was even discussing dissipation. What I was saying is that the amount of electrons that are required to be involved for one current, 1 coulomb of current to flow in that circuit, that amount of electrons is what's required. If you didn't have that, you couldn't have it. Can you have more than that number of available valence electrons? Of course you can. There again, of course, the resistance would be lower. But I wasn't saying how many. I was just, what there was no discussion of power dissipation there. I was just basically saying that if you were looking at a cross-section and if there was a coulomb of energy, that's the amount of electrons that are required to be energized as the energy is moving through. KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you used the word coulomb of energy. Did you mean to say coulomb of charge? A coulomb is not energy. A coulomb is an amount of charge. Did you mean a coulomb of charge in your last sentence? Go ahead.
Yeah, that was a poor way of describing it. What I'm saying is that when you have a coulomb worth of charge where you're allowing electrons to pass, and you would do that electron count at that time in that cross-section, that's the amount of available valence electrons that you would need in that area for the coulomb basically just basically for the current. That's what I was looking for, not coulomb. I meant current to flow through that cross section. So